You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Mike McCarg. Mike is a Christian turned atheist turned Jesus follower who uses his story to help people know God in an age of science. Mike is a host and co-host of two podcasts, Ask Science Mike and The Liturgist Podcast. They've attracted a curious following of Christians, the spiritually interested and the religiously unaffiliated. He's an in-demand speaker and he writes for Storyline, Sojourners, and Relevant. And you probably know him as Science Mike. Mike, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. So I think you grew up in Florida. Is that right?
If my accent doesn't testify to that, I'll confirm. Totally a North Florida kid.
Well, I grew up in West Texas, and I often am told that I don't have an accent from there. So it's proof that it can be done. What was that atmosphere like?
Hot, humid, a lot of pollen. I guess you're not asking about the air.
That's fine too.
Tallahassee is kind of a blue county in a sea of rural red. So it's Bible Belt liberal.
Okay, sure.
So that's, you know, that would be like a really conservative Republican in California. you know, it was fun. I like Tallahassee. I had a little problem with bullying, being a nerd as a kid. But the kind of religious fundamentalism that typifies evangelicalism down here was pretty beneficial for me. I didn't have like any great conflict with my religious upbringing until much later.
In your book, you talk about that you're a pretty awkward kid. I should mention, so your new book is called Finding God in the Waves, How I Lost My Faith and Found It Again Through Science. You spend a good amount of time just talking about your upbringing. And, you know, it's essentially like a memoir, a spiritual memoir. I love that you spent so much time talking about yourself as a kid, because I think that, you know, none of this stuff comes in a vacuum. We are the products of our past. You talk a lot about how you were kind of an awkward kid, bullied a lot and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was a super nerdy kid. I was a computer programmer at seven. I really loved science fiction. I wore Hawaiian shirts. I had a ginger carrot top bowl cut. I was deeply imaginative. I went to school one day and I told all the kids there that I was a werewolf. So like I got bullied a lot, but I earned that interaction. I did everything kids are supposed to do wrong. But when I sat down to write the book, you know, I'm not really into writing memoirs, believe it or not. I think kind of the shift in the second half of the book to application matters. But the reason I included that narrative context in the first half of the book was to help the reader examine their own past using mine as a point of reference. To, you know, by seeing how my relationship with God and other people developed through my childhood, to get them to reflect on their own, and also to give an excuse to talk about, you know, how the image of God starts to form in our brains, which is something I go into much more depth in the second half of the book. But, you know, it's a weird volume, because like you say, the first half is very memoir driven. But the point of the memoir is to set the stage for the scientific explorations that happen in the second half of the book.
And you grew up in a pretty conservative home, going to a Southern Baptist church, very similar to my upbringing. They come off pretty well in the book. You know, there's some things about them that are overly simplistic. You know, a lot of the theology that comes with the conservative upbringing. But it seems like you felt like they were a pretty loving bunch.
Yeah, I didn't want to. There's such a temptation, I think, in our culture for people that have gone through some form of deconstruction or faith transition to put the people in their past in the role of antagonist in their story. And that just wasn't the case for me. And I didn't want to be dismissive of all the beautiful things I got from conservative evangelicalism. And I wanted to honor the relationships with those people that I still hold. And so the easy thing would have been to write how, you know, people mistreated me or people responded to me in a negative way. But that wouldn't, A, be truthful, or B, help people understand where some of the relational dynamics come in with people who have different views on faith, especially people who transition. And that's an incredibly common thing statistically in the United States. 43% of people have at least one major faith transition in their life. And when you have a faith transition, automatically, suddenly there's people who knew and expected you to have one set of beliefs, and suddenly they find that you have a different set of beliefs. And it was really important to me in this book that I helped people explore that tension and understand how to maintain healthy relationships given that faith transition context.
So you
have... Are these like the wordiest, nerdiest answers you've ever had on the show? You're like, here's a really simple story question, and then...
Not at all. Not at all. So that's weird. Perfect. No, no. That's exactly what I want to know when I ask that question. So, you know, you had this faith experience when you were 7. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Where you felt
my first, like, really powerful mystical experience was when I was 7. Yeah.
Oh, and here's the other thing that I really wanted to know. I need to know about this proton pack that you built when you were a kid. You...
So that's a real thing.
Yeah, yeah. So for the listeners, you kind of mentioned in passing, oh, I like took apart a VCR and like made a Ghostbusters proton pack with it, which is like, you know, for those who aren't our age and intimately familiar with Ghostbusters, it's like, you know, their laser gun that they killed the ghosts with. So go on, explain this proton pack.
Well, I always had to know how everything worked. Always, my whole life. And so my parents gave me a VCR with the old TV in my room so I could watch movies. And I decided to take it apart one day. And I did successfully in a day completely disassemble this VCR. I didn't take notes as I did so. So my dad comes home. He sees the VCR in pieces across my bed. And he says, if you can't get that put back together, you can't watch any of your videos. So I kind of panicked and I put it back together and it miraculously looked the same, but it did not work.
Did you have some leftover screws and parts sitting around after you put
there,
it together?
There were some leftover screws. There were no leftover parts, but, you know, it was not an operational VCR. And so I had a lunchbox and I decided I would build my own computer because I'd seen the inside of a computer and I wanted to replicate that. And so I kind of put the stuff in there, and then there's this kind of round magnetic head in a VCR, which is lost on a huge percentage of this audience, even people who are alive at the time. But when you put a tape in, it came out across this round spinning head, and that's how it got the signal. And I didn't know what to do with that. It didn't look like anything in a computer, so I just put it in the middle of the lunchbox. And one of my friends came over, and he told me it looked like the inside of a proton pack. So he started building his own proton pack. And then I took that lunchbox with all these parts secured inside it and ran a cable out of it and then put it in a backpack and ran that cable to this like really weird gas valve I'd found on my grandparents' farm, which looked like a high-tech gun of some kind. And we ran around the neighborhood trying to catch ghosts. And then two of our friends saw us doing that. They built their own proton pack. So literally the four of us would run around our neighborhood at night with the most wonderful imaginative childhood belief that we were protecting our neighbors from unseen forces using science.
That is the most 1980s thing I've heard in so, so long.
Oh man, it was a total 80s thing, yeah.
Oh, that's so great. Okay, so back to your spiritual, you know, experience when you were 7. So you have that experience, which I get the impression was really real to you, and it did not help
the bullying and the awkwardness that you were at school, right?
Not at all. No.
You were, you describe yourself, and I love this, that you weren't like some people think of stereotypical nerdy kids as an introvert. Like, you're pretty extroverted. Like, you're in your face about your awkwardness.
No, I tried to talk to everybody. I tried to draw them into my elaborate play fantasies. I wore my emotions, like, maybe not on my sleeve. I wore my emotions on their sleeves, maybe. So it just made kids uncomfortable. And I had no ability to, like, read social cues and understand, like, this is what, like, a normal kid who wants to be popular does. I had no athletic ability, absolutely no ability to kind of discern what was fashionable or what people should be wearing. Yeah, I was just like, I was exactly like the kids in Revenge of the Nerds, another classic 80s movie, except I kept trying to talk to everybody. I didn't get the fact that I wasn't supposed to belong, because solitude and quiet didn't come naturally to me.
So that faith, though, it seems like it works for you for a while. You kind of had some, you know, some young adult rebellion for a while, but you
mild on the overall spectrum of possible young
sure
adult rebellions.
Yeah, like, you know, destructive relationships and sleeping in through church, which would definitely fall under the mild
right,
the mild rebellion, you know, since I was like a 33-year-old might happen to sleep through church sometimes. So, yeah, you know, it works for you. You meet the woman who would become your wife and pursue her with success eventually. And she's committed in her relationship with God. And then it seems like kind of an inciting incident for you was when your dad called a family meeting when you were a young adult, right?
Yes, you just blew my mind, actually. I diagrammed out the story. And I did not write that as the inciting incident, and it completely is.
Oh, awesome. Cool. I mean, well, you got that point across. It yeah. Seems like that's where kind of things come to a head for you.
It totally is, yeah.
So you're and how old would you have been when that happened?
Oh, man. I have this learning disability where I don't do chronological time.
You were like in your mid-20s is what I gathered. Is that,
yeah, yeah,
that
I was
fair?
In my,
somewhere
I was
in there?
My 20s, sure.
What, you know, here's the thing I think
late
about.
Late 20s, probably.
Okay, late 20s. Were you shocked at how affected you were by your parents saying that they're going to get a divorce in your late 20s, like when you were an adult?
Well, I think I was in denial first.
That it was happening,
like,
at all.
My first response was, as this deacon, spiritual leader, I'm going to help my dad. We're going to fix it. We're going to do Bible study. We're going to pray. And when friends and counselors in my life would say, this is going to affect you. You've got to watch out for your own emotions. You've got to watch out for your own marriage. I would think, what are you talking about? What's wrong with you? I didn't have an affair. I'm not going to be estranged from my wife. What is your problem? And it was only as I started to kind of move through the stages of grief that the pain and the personal effects started to manifest themselves from that process. And then, yes, I was extremely surprised the degree to which I doubted my ability to be a good husband. I doubted my ability to be a good father. And I started to question all these assumptions I'd built my life on, because to such a large degree, even though my dad is this, like, former military jock and I'm this computer programmer nerd, I'd still largely modeled my life on my dad's example. And now I was questioning if that example was good or not. And it was frightening and at some points even debilitating. And I think divorce is so common that our society has really learned to deal with it. But if you've grown up and your parents made it 30 years, you kind of make the assumption that you're one of those families who doesn't have to deal with divorce.
You're in the clear.
You're in the clear. What is there to worry about? And I was really shocked to find that we were not in the clear.
I think you must have also kind of had the feeling of like, you know, when you were talking to your dad and trying to, you know, remind him of all of the Bible verses that say he shouldn't be getting divorced. I mean, there must have also been a sense of you thinking and saying like, hey, you guys are the ones who taught me this stuff. Like, maybe not directly, but like, you're the ones who took me to church to where I learned all this stuff that I'm now telling you you're supposed to do.
And in my family, it was directly. Like, they took us to church, but we also prayed in our home. Yeah. We studied the Bible. We talked about spiritual things. So my folks literally were the people who taught me about marriage and what the Bible says about it. And that's, there was an odd sort of role reversal moment as I started to tell my dad what the scripture says, because it was my assumption he already knew.
So at this time, you had really bought into conservative Christianity wholesale. You were, like you mentioned, you were a deacon in your church and you were teaching Sunday school. You had two kids at the time, I think. And so your world gets rocked. And then it's about that time that somebody that you meet who doesn't know, who's not religious, who is an atheist, you kind of develop a relationship and you're challenged to read The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. Is that
it? Was The God Delusion, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, you kind of get rocked by that and you keep going. You read some Carl Sagan, who, my impression of Sagan is he's just more of a, he's more about science than atheism, but there's, you see, you know, there's relation there.
Sagan doesn't like argue atheism. He assumes it.
Sure.
Which is in many ways actually more powerful and more persuasive than what Dawkins or many of the new atheists do. He's like, let's talk about the wonders of science. And people say, what about God? He's like, what do you mean? What about God? You know, like, sure. What about dragons? That's a weird question.
A Sagan book is not an apologetic for atheism like the way that a Dawkins book is.
Completely.
So, you know, I'm curious. You had from a young age a really analytical mind. And so I'm wondering what it was like to read Dawkins for the first time. And I wonder if there's a sense of like, oh, how have I never thought of this before?
Oh, wow.
That's, you know what I mean?
Shane, you've got mad skills, man. You're really catching up on the inner monologue and reflections that I didn't write down. Because that absolutely... there was like a little bit of shame, like as I read The God Delusion. Yeah. Like, how did I miss this? I kind of write in the book, I was really kind of overconfident going into The God Delusion because I felt like I already understood science. I had a lot of friends who were atheists. I had a lot of really no holds barred discussions and debates about the merit of God as an idea. And the deeper I got into God Delusion, the more I realized that there were a lot of angles and arguments I'd never heard or considered. And it did make me feel surprised and flat-footed that these were not things I'd contemplated before.
And you, I feel like you must have also thought, not only have I not thought this before, but like, how did I make it to, you know, 28, 29, however old you were, without thinking this before? I mean, maybe that's the same thought, but just the, like, gosh, I've devoted a lot of my life without considering all of these questions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's more than that. I was confident, like, I dare say certain, that I'd already considered all the significant questions in that realm and answered them. Now, for people with any kind of contemplative, or I would dare say even, you know, mainline theological experience or training, that's a almost unimaginable statement. But if you're brought up in the conservative evangelical tradition, they sell you on a lot of certainty. They let you know that these ideas are tested, these ideas are proven, these are things that are absolutely trustworthy. And only when I read The God Delusion did I realize how much I'd accepted that promise without scrutiny.
So you essentially become, you doubt, but so much of your identity, it seems like, is built into being the good Christian, conservative, you know, that guy, Sunday school teacher and deacon and dad and husband and all that kind of stuff. Then that can be, so that's a hard, like, that's a hard closet to come out of. And so you essentially became like a secret atheist for a number of years, right?
Yes. A little over 2 years, I was an acting deacon in my church, a Sunday school teacher, bass player in the worship band, and atheist. But no one knew.
I think what was so interesting about reading that part was, you know, I think we think that atheists are always cynical about faith, and for sure some are, but, you know, you led one of your daughters to Christ while you were a secret atheist. You really embraced teaching Sunday school while you were an atheist. You cried when your daughter was baptized when you were a secret atheist. It's not so, in real life, it seems like it's just not so clean cut. Like, there's some part of you that was really glad to see these acts of faith going on.
Yeah, so our brains are drawn to simplified narratives so we can understand the world and feel confident. And we're especially prone to simplify people our brains identify as outside our own group. So Christians are aware that there is this complexity and nuance and diversity in ideas within Christianity. Even within conservative denominations like the SBC, there's a variety of understandings about God and beliefs about the scripture that, you know, fit within a certain core set of agreements. But, you know, there's a pretty thriving Calvinism versus Arminianism debate.
Sure.
Within the SBC. And then we turn around and say, but all Muslims are all atheists, right? And just lump all of them together. And in fact, there's a tremendous ideological diversity among atheists. An atheist is just someone who lacks belief in any god or gods. So some people don't believe in God, and they don't care if you believe in God. Some people don't believe in God, and they think that belief in God is harmful and dangerous for human society, which we tend to call people like that anti-theists instead of atheists. And the thing I've discovered is a great many atheists don't have problems with people of faith. They just want to be free to not practice faith without persecution. And when I was an atheist, I couldn't let go of all the beautiful things that I had seen faith do in people's lives. I'd seen marriages healed. I'd seen people deal with drug addiction and other behavioral issues because of their faith. And the last thing I wanted to do was take that coping mechanism away from other people.
You know, as I was reading, I had this thought and I actually tweeted it out. And so for listeners, just a little hint here, if I tweet something out that comes out of left field, it's probably because I'm reading a book that that I'm about to interview the author for. But it was so interesting to me reading that and hearing you talk about atheists. And I thought, how much alike are Christians and atheists in that there's a general, we're both kind of generally perceived negatively by the public at large, Because the worst examples of each of us tend to speak the loudest. You know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. The public discourse is dominated by the lunatic fringe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and in, you know, the caricature of the spiteful atheist is out there because they're the ones who have the microphone. The caricature of the hateful Christian is out there because they're the ones who have the microphone as well. And there's tons of us who are both, we're both kind of sitting here saying, that's not me. That's not who we really are. You had a weekend with Rob Bell and kind of a little workshop that he put on. Tell me really quick how that came about.
Well, my friend Stratton helps Rob organize his events and social media and web presence. And they were putting together, Rob had this idea to do a conference on creativity called 2 Days with Rob Bell. And they'd never done an event registration on Rob's website. And since I'm a nerd, they asked me to help test that. And so I did, and that got me the first ticket to a 2 Days Rob Bell. And I was kind of torn about going because although Rob had been an interesting figure that kind of helped me hold on to my faith with my fingernails on the way out, I was still out, and I was worried about the kind of social pressure or religious assumptions that could come with being stuck in a room of pastors for 2 days. But I worked in advertising, and anyone who's ever done professional creative work, you don't know where your ideas come from, and you don't know when they're going to come. And a lot of times it's an hour before a meeting, and you finally get the idea for the campaign, and you pull it off. And as soon as you walk out of the meeting, you go, I'm never going to be able to do that again. And I'm going to lose my job. So Rob is this like amazing creative person. I mean, he is a phenomenally creative person with a high output of really genre redefining work. And if he was going to kind of share his toolbox or how he did that, I was more than happy to rate it. So I agreed to kind of go to this conference, especially because I was already going to be in California in that time period because I'd been selected to go to this NASA public outreach event. So on two sides of a weekend, I went and saw like the crowning achievements of mankind in science at NASA and then checked out what pastors had to say about creativity. And I got more than I bargained for out of that conference for sure.
So you had, I mean, that's also kind of an inciting incident that weekend. I mean, that's kind of when your faith was kind of rekindled. Is that right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, that was the big bang of my new faith.
One of the things that I thought was so interesting was that when you had an experience and I would think, okay, this is going to be one of the turning points for him, you like analyze it and dissect it and see how like science and not something mysterious is behind it.
Yes. I look a gift horse in the mouth for sure. Following my moment in the presence of God.
But I think that that's really valuable too, because we often don't do that. We're just like, oh, it's just, you know, God, or, you know, and, you know, it's like people who used to think like medicine didn't work or, you know, there's some kind of natural reason for something, but we just chalk it up to God, which not mutually exclusive, but, you know, when we're talking atheism and Christianity, you can understand why we make those distinctions. So, but something happened during that weekend with Rob that you couldn't nail down in a rational way. Is that fair?
Yes. That's more than fair.
I don't want to give the cow away. People should read the book. It seems like you had a lot of rebuilding to do. It seems like your faith is a lot different than it was pre-atheism, but that's where some things kind of started making sense.
Yeah. And I think if I say it plainly enough, it doesn't give the cow away. So what happened at that conference is I heard Jesus talk to me and then stood in the presence of God physically. And if that doesn't make you curious enough to buy the book, I don't know what will. The problem for me was, no matter how moving and powerful those experiences were, I couldn't prove they didn't just happen in my brain as hallucinations. And that started this period of searching. At first, I tried to read works of theology and scripture again, but it was too much too soon, too many assumptions I couldn't accept. And it only made me doubt my experience more. So instead, I started to look at who we believe God is, God that created us, God that sustains us. And I started to look for that God in science, starting with cosmology. And I found some version of God I'd call Einstein's God or Spinoza's God in that process. But worshiping such a God makes no sense. It's a God that's distant, that's maybe not even aware. And I had to figure out, well, so that God is plausible in science, but millions of people feel close to God like God is more than a force or an organizing principle of reality. They experience a God that is personal. So where in science can we find a God like that? And it was only when I found a new branch of study called neurotheology, which is the study of how human brains respond to God, that I started to find a God that we could know. And my faith practice became predicated not upon Christian theology or scriptural practices, but on a scientific validation of Christian traditions and practices that then led to some mystical knowledge or mystical understanding of the God that I serve today.
I wonder what you think when you hear the false dichotomies between faith and science going around. What do you think when you see that in pop culture, when you see Bill Nye taking a tour of the Ark with Ken Ham? What's your response to all of that?
Sometimes there is a conflict between science and faith. If you read a Bible with a certain reference frame, with a certain 50-cent word epistemology, a certain means of knowing and understanding information, then the Bible tells you that the earth was created in 6 literal 24-hour days. And, frankly, science does paint a radically different picture. Using well-cited, well-sourced information and observation, science would make the claim that the universe is closer to 14 billion years old, and that what is described in a single sentence in Genesis, "let there be light," alone took 380,000 years. And in that frame, you see science and faith in conflict. And so I understand why that happens in pop culture, because science is reacting not to faith in general, but specific claims from people who make unscientific assertions based on their interpretation of religious knowledge. And I've talked about this using this analogy. It would be as if you had a group of carpenters and a group of gardeners. Both are respectable, trustworthy disciplines. But if I walk outside with gardeners who are working on their knees with spades and start to bang on their roses with a hammer, it's going to be a problem. And the same way, if someone walks inside with a group of carpenters who are putting up drywall and start to dig through that newly hung drywall with a shovel, it's going to be a problem. The conflict between science and faith arises when we use these lenses for interpreting the human experience in ways they are not intended to be used.
So one of the things I really, really wanted to ask you about, and I don't think I told you this, but I wanted to interview you before I realized you had a book coming out. And I sent the interview request to you or, you know, one of your gatekeepers or something like that. And then, you know, I think I went to your site and I saw the book was coming out, which, by the way, my original plan was to just ask you what I wanted to ask you and then maybe mention the book. But I started reading the book. I started reading the book, and it is exceedingly accessible. And I was just so drawn in. And so, you know, I want people to know it's not, you don't need to know anything about science to read it. Just so wonderfully written that it's just a pleasure to read. But here's what I wanted to ask you about. Is someone who deals with science and deals with faith, I think what I'm more interested in is Christian's relationship to science, because it's super rocky for a lot of people. And I wonder, it seems like that's probably something you've thought about a lot, and I wonder why you think that is.
It's an unspoken assumption. That's the difference between a scientific mindset and a mindset of faith. Science as a discipline is nothing but a method for uncovering facts about physical reality. That's what science is. And it's built on an assumption called empiricism. Now, what is empiricism? Empiricism is a philosophy that says you should put confidence in a belief that's proportional to the amount of evidence you have for that belief. In other words, follow the data. Believe what you can demonstrate with evidence. And I don't think anybody has a problem with empiricism per se. Every time a court of law convicts a criminal or acquits a criminal, it does so on the basis of evidence. Science and people of faith agree that it's good to make decisions based on evidence. The difference is people of faith accept different types of evidence than scientists do. Scientists don't accept, because they don't have evidence for it, that God creates any sort of general or special revelation for people as a means of finding out information or truth. And religious people do. They accept their personal experiences with God as a way of validating that God exists. They accept the testimonies of miracles in Scripture as a way of validating God's existence and God's nature and God's character. And scientists would say those are huge claims that frankly are depicting events that don't seem plausible in physics, and some ancient manuscripts aren't sufficient evidence to establish those things as fact. And that's where the tension comes in. That's where the rocky relationship happens, because the more you explore science, on the one hand, it's incredible to see these beautiful mechanistic actions that cause our reality to be. But on the other hand, science can often reveal facts that seem to offer no support for the idea that there's a God behind it, architecting it all. Photons do what photons do without any supervision. Protons and electrons and atoms and molecules all do what they do without intervention. And science also starts to reveal a universe that tends to be kind of self-organizing. It reveals life that tends to create life. And it can subvert a lot of our assumptions about an active God in the universe. And I think that's the genesis of that conflict and that rocky relationship.
Okay, so that explains why scientists, secularists would reject some evidence that Christians don't reject. I think what I'm curious about is why so many Christians reject evidence, scientific data that secularists, that scientists don't. So, and even evidence that does not contradict their faith. So, like, I get that Christians reject evidence about evolution because they think that, and I say Christians, fundamentalist Christians, because they believe in a literal 7-day creation. I get that. I think that there's a link, and some people might say that this is a stretch, and this is what I want to know what you think about. There's a link to that, and Christians who reject things like systematic racism and injustice, when we can go look at data that, you know, practically, empirically, you know, proves that that is going on. But Christians seem to be really, really skeptical of that. And it seems like there's a fundamental breakdown in relationship between with Christians and science. Does that follow?
It does. And it's because the primary driver of human belief is not actually evidence, is not actually an examination of clues, is not even rational thinking or rationalizations. The primary driver for human beliefs is social identity. Mm. We believe what the people who describe themselves with the same words we describe ourselves believe. But that also means to understand what any given person may believe, you have to look at the complete set of labels they use to describe themselves. So, for example, if we talk about global climate change, something that is basically universally accepted among scientists and non-religious people in the United States, yet largely rejected by, quote, Christians, unquote. When you dig a little deeper in that data, you find that it's actually a dominant subgroup of Christians who reject climate change. And those are Christians who identify, or people that identify themselves both as Christians and conservative politically. That when you look at Christians who don't identify as conservative politically, they could identify as independent or even progressive or liberal, you find that gap in belief in climate change starts to evaporate. And so it's not actually a Christians versus secularist stance. It's a conservative versus non-conservative, because some people are moderates and moderates split the difference between liberals and conservatives on acceptance of climate change. And so you have to tease out that data a little bit further. The same thing appears to be true for issues like systemic racism. That it's a confluence of multiple social labels. The thing science reveals to us, neuroscience, that's fascinating, is that as soon as you apply a label to yourself and you accept that as part of your identity, you start to unconsciously filter out information that you view as threatening to that identity. And it's not something you do on purpose. You're completely unaware of it. And that's certainly true of conservative Christian Republicans, but it's also true of liberal Democrat atheists. All of those people, as soon as you use those terms, you're creating unconscious filters on the way you process information.
I think that makes so much sense as to why, or it explains so well why politics are so geographic. That if you live in a rural area, you probably think one way. And if you live in an urban area, you think one way. You know, same for, in general terms, the South and the North. Essentially, we look at the people around us and say, these are good people. The things they tell me are probably true and I should go along with it. It kind of sounds like that's a more rudimentary version of what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in my own experience, I am what? I grew up in the South. At one time, I identified as more conservative politically and theologically than I do now. But as a teenager, I labeled myself alternative and countercultural, which I can't deny that probably a lot of how I see the world today is because at a formative period in my cognition, my social identity label became reacting to the norm in my community in the opposite way. Yes, it's really, it can sound cynical, but sometimes the behavior of humans makes a lot more sense and is a lot more actionable if you imagine instead, you know, these rational, enlightened humans, you know, just very clever apes walking around with cell phones and wearing clothes. And then kind of a reactionary thing, because it doesn't matter if two chimps are fighting. If someone outside their troop comes along, they're both going to turn and react extremely energetically to that outsider. And humans, by the numbers, are actually a more violent species than chimpanzees.
That's not really hard for me to believe. Mike, this has been really fun. Thanks. The book is fantastic. And obviously, everybody listening knows we'll have links to it on the show notes and everything. You got a tour coming up. your podcast, Ask Science Mike, and then you're part of, you co-host the Liturgist podcast, Michael Gunger, too. So we'll have all links to that on the show notes and stuff. Mike, it's just been so good. I've been wanting to have you on for a long time. So, man, thanks for coming on the show.
What a great conversation. It was totally my pleasure, Shane. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that my best.